All right, so, this is such a big subject, this subject of anger. I'm going to start in with a few things to say, and then we'll go from there. But one thing to say right away is that when we use the word anger, when Rodney and I use the word anger, we also mean its variations. We mean frustration, impatience, annoyance, irritation, rage. Can you hear me in the back? Okay, rage. We mean resentment, hatred, and ill will, and bitterness. And I might have... that was a pretty comprehensive list, but if I left anything out that you experienced, then add it to the list. Which, what?
Feeling impatient or overwhelmed.
Yes, like impatient, absolutely, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I wanted to encourage you throughout the day today, or for those of you who will be here tomorrow as well, to be aware not just of anger, you know, but of the fact that whenever we're with people, there is a chance for at least irritation and annoyance to arise. So one way that we learn about anything that overwhelms us and that is seemingly too strong at times to work with is to take it on in its more subtle forms. You know, not to think, oh yes, we should just work with anger when it arises, something like that. But when we notice its more subtle forms, impatience, you know, might happen a lot during the day today or tomorrow. Some degree of frustration or annoyance or feeling that other people aren't cooperating, you know, the way that they should. And so then one has a reaction to that. So to work with the more subtle manifestations of something that is seemingly too strong for us to work with is an extremely elegant and valuable way to get practice so that when it's really strong, we won't be quite as bowled over by it. Yeah. So really, throughout the day today and tomorrow, see if you can, if there isn't strong anger arising at any point, see if you can be aware of its more subtle manifestations. And that would be a way to really integrate what we're talking about and what you're reflecting upon. I was thinking that everybody here in this room already has a lot of wisdom to come to a day or two where the subject is anger. It's not something that a lot of people would choose to spend their Saturday or their weekend doing, to look at the difficult, to look at the unpleasant, and yet to want to learn about this sometimes very powerful energy that bowls us over that we don't know what to do with, is wisdom. Because in identifying that anger is happening, that it's a problem, that we know it's occurring, that we know we're having difficulty with it, it is the beginning of transformation. You know, transformation can't happen unless we know what's going on and unless we're taking a real interest in what's going on inwardly. So just to recognize that fact, that the process of transformation takes place, not, of course, right in this moment. I'm sure it's happened many moments before this moment, where there has been an awareness that one is having difficulty with this troublesome emotion. Now, there's different ways to work with anger, and certainly having a few methods and techniques is really helpful. And then, as well, to come about it from the viewpoint of investigation, wisdom, understanding is also important. I think that it's such a complex emotion, and oftentimes it is so difficult to deal with, that it stands us in good stead to have a lot of different ways to work with it, not just one. You know, although, of course, I would say, and I know Rodney agrees with me, that a wisdom approach is the best because it's a way of seeing underneath what's happening and actually uprooting a torment of heart. At the same time, sometimes you can't just cut to the chase in that way because other ways of working may be more skillful in the moment. And I think that it's actually wisdom to be open to all sorts of different ways of working with anger. Yeah. So, one thing that helps so much is to know how to calm ourselves when we're angry. And what we did this morning earlier, and I'd love to hear once we start having more discussion to hear how that went for you, but to find a way to stay in your body when you're experiencing anger or when anger is coming towards you is a very, very good way to work. It's a good practice to know. Being in the body, finding a way to stay in one's body is important. And I was offering the touch points this morning because it's a way to, in systematically moving through the body in this way, next time you're angry, you might remember that it will help to calm yourself. You know, I offered a workshop on anger at CIMC probably a couple of years ago now, maybe the first time I did. And a full year later, people were saying, oh, thank you for the touch points. You know, I thought it was the simplest thing that was said during the day. But the touch points really come in handy. So that's a particular method that we can work with. And Rodney mentioned that we're going to be working with different methods during the sittings. So, you know, one of those methods, of course, is practicing loving-kindness meditation because it can really help. Loving-kindness meditation is an antidote to anger. And if we know where to send the loving-kindness to, you know, oftentimes when we're angry at someone, we have to send it to ourselves and not the person that we're angry at. Because if we're sending it to the person we're angry at, it's really, you know, tempting to move into, you know, if you're happy, you won't be causing me so much trouble. It really can turn so easily into something that is manipulative and controlling. And the fact is, when anger is happening, it is suffering. Whether we recognize it or not as suffering, it is suffering. And sometimes it feels very pleasant, and we feel very powerful at times when we might not want to feel helpless and powerless. And so there's a pleasantness about it. And of course, you know, other times it feels intensely unpleasant. But whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, it is suffering. And to recognize anger as a kalesa, which means a torment of the heart, is seeing it clearly. You know? And I think that this kind of understanding is really important because it offers the right or the wise orientation or the wise perspective that anger is suffering. Another way that we'll work with one of the sittings is to just perhaps relax the body, you know, because it helps a lot to just relax the muscles when anger is happening. And as well to look at our thoughts and to label the thoughts that we have, which is an extremely powerful way to work with anger. Because when we're playing the thought back to ourselves, it's so interesting to actually hear what we're saying. Because when we're angry, oftentimes what is being said inside is so utterly grandiose and absurd and far-fetched and dramatic and all of those things. To play it back to oneself, it's like a mirror, and it helps so much. And it is a way to take the charge out of the thought so that the thought is no longer a problem. Now, it's a way to, in a sense, take the toxicity out of the thought so that a thought becomes a thought. In terms of seeing anger as suffering, this means to change our orientation in that oftentimes we see anger as either good or bad. Yeah. And this we have learned in the culture. We have learned through our families to see anger as good or bad. And to see it as suffering is really different. Yeah. So to look at what one's attitude or one's stance is, of course, when anger is unpleasant and when we see the effect it has on others and when we're experiencing someone else's anger and we don't know what to do, this is where we see it as bad. And if we see anger as bad, and then of course you can so easily move into the identification of I am bad, you know, or I am an angry person, and then we're kind of sunk at that point. You know, because of that stance of anger is bad. All sorts of things come out of having this viewpoint that anger is bad. If it's bad, what, of course, one does inevitably is we hate that anger is happening. It's inevitable if we see it as bad to then hate that anger is happening and to hate ourselves because anger is happening. You know, to have this very solid sense of who I am because the energy of anger is happening. When we hate anything, we are perpetuating what we don't want to have happening. So in other words, if we hate hatred, you know, there's just going to be more hatred. You know, if we're angry with our anger, the consequence of that, the result of that, of course, inevitably, is going to be more anger. So it doesn't get us out of the cycle to hate anger. Ajahn Chah said that, I have to translate a little bit here. He uses the word arahant in this, and arahant means someone who is deeply free. And he also uses the word kalesas, and kalesas, my favorite translation of the word kalesa is torment of heart. So, translating arahant as one far from the kalesas is wrong. Oftentimes, the word arahant is translated as one far from the torments of heart. So he's saying that translating arahant as one far from the kalesas is wrong. He or she is not far from the kalesas at all, but right up against them. The difference is that an arahant knows how to not grasp hold of them. Yeah? This gives us a real path. This one statement actually opens up a path of practice, that it's not the presence of a torment of heart. It's not the presence of anger that's a problem, you know. And we're really in error if we make the presence of anger into a problem. It's our relationship to anger that is a real problem. And so we learn when anger arises that to grasp hold of that anger, either to cling to it or to dwell on it or to perpetuate it, of course, is going to bring more suffering. But to not accept it as something natural that arises and passes away, that is not self, that is not me, that is not mine, then we can let anger arise, we can stay still in the midst of it, and we can let it pass away. So we're not tampering with it. But I think to do this, there's a word that I like that really sounds like an oxymoron. And what it is becoming angry Buddha. I thought of this because there's a teaching on hot Buddha, cold Buddha. And the hot Buddha, cold Buddha teaching is when you're hot, just be hot. You know, accept that heat is happening. When you're cold, just be cold. Accept that cold is happening. So just kind of taking that teaching another step, angry Buddha is a way to be safe when anger is happening. It's a way to create a sense of safety. Because when we look at any statue of the Buddha, and of course we have to remember that these statues don't breathe, they don't experience pain, they never have a problem with their knee, they actually do not experience anger. But still, the image of the Buddha, you know, is very serene. All of the images of the Buddha that we see, very serene, very beautiful smiles, and kind of that aura of peacefulness that people who aren't even interested in these things get attracted by. You know, lots of people love Buddhas and they have no interest in the practice at all, because there's something that's really compelling about that peacefulness. So when we think of the image of the Buddha in that sense of peacefulness, we can also recognize that the heart of the Buddha is big enough to embrace everything without moving. You know? I mean, this is what keeps us safe with this very powerful, sometimes enormously destructive energy, is that it keeps us safe, and it's a way to take the toxicity out of the energy by sitting with it, by encouraging that sense of serenity and calm and peacefulness and non-movement, non-doing, not trying to fix or change or come up with something, but trusting in awareness, you know, trusting that in the stillness, in not moving for or against. Now, seeing it, of course, as it is, as a torment of heart, and not siding with it in any way, not moving towards it and not wishing it would go away, not trying to get rid of it, which only causes more, and not dwelling in it or encouraging more thinking about it, but seeing if we can sit just as the Buddha does. And when I say sit, sometimes I mean literally sit, but we can be walking, we can be lying down, doesn't matter what the posture is, it's an inner attitude of openness and acceptance and being able to make room for without being destroyed by and without destroying anyone else. Yeah? Making room for this very powerful energy. And then it loses its destructive nature if we can bring the Buddha heart into being. And this is something that is possible for each one of us to do. And so this is what I mean by angry Buddha, not the Buddha being angry, but being able to embrace, being able to welcome, being able to let anger come through us without it getting stuck. And of course, you know, this process has to do with acknowledging and recognizing that anger is happening and then staying very still, not moving, not acting. You know, seeing if we can really experience it without fear, not be intimidated by this energy arising, but seeing if instead we can make room for it inwardly, knowing that we're not going to cause harm. Yeah, it's quite a beautiful image that it's possible to embrace and accept and allow for and at the same time observe it and investigate it without it being a problem. Because if we don't do that, if we see anger as just simply bad and shouldn't be happening and kind of, you know, I should be over this, or this should not be happening, or I should not be experiencing anger, or I've been practicing all these years, why am I still experiencing anger, or any of these kinds of things, we do react with denial and repression. And then it comes out in a different way. Yeah, I think we all know this, actually, that it does come out in a surprising way at times. Or we get physically sick. Or we find that we have all this muscle tension and we don't know where it's come from. So that's seeing anger as bad. If we have the other viewpoint, which is that anger is good, it's a problem too. And most of us are fairly confused about this because we see it at times as good and at times as bad. You know, most of us don't always see it as bad. Some of us do, but most of us don't. Some of us, we see it in a complex way. Sometimes good, sometimes bad. But times when we see anger as good, I think we have to really look into as well. Because I do think that if we're getting behind it in this way, you know, that anger is good, then what follows, of course, would be the tendency to indulge in it, the tendency to perpetuate it, the tendency to rev it up and add to it. Why not? Because it's good. And then to express it, of course, is even better. You know, that whole cultural, I think, cultural misunderstanding about venting being that we get rid of something. You know, that if we act it out, it's this idea of all this being inside of us, and then if we act it out, it's going to release it, and we're going to get rid of it. And, you know, not to say at times if you have a real background of being frozen with your emotions and this kind of thing. Sometimes, of course, it can be helpful in a certain environment and with great consciousness to, you know, to act it out in a certain way. But generally, I think it stems from this idea of thinking of it as good. And then the consequences of thinking of it as good is that we justify it. We get behind it and we justify it. And then out of that justification comes the tendency to express it in a way that isn't wise. And then in expressing it, we are practicing it. You know, we are rehearsing it in a certain way. We're rehearsing it so that there'll be another time when we'll be expressing it. We're practicing it, and whatever we practice, you know, we get good at. So if we're practicing expressing our anger, then we get good at that. Thich Nhat Hanh, I think he had somebody asked him about this, about venting their anger, you know, by beating their pillow. And he said, not quite like this, but he kind of had this kind of thing. He said, but what about the poor pillow? You know? You know, we're beating this poor pillow. And, you know, isn't it something that we're actually practicing? I have just this cute little thing that I found in the paper some years ago about the subway in New York City. So I guess that one morning the subway was held up for about 20 minutes and passengers were reacting in all sorts of ways that one could easily imagine. So it says the riders were getting restless, especially one extremely vexed fellow who was yelling at the token clerk. Just when the police arrived, the man shouted, "I gotta get somewhere. This is called rapid transit. Officers, rapid transit." "And this," the officer replied sternly, "is called calm down. Nobody cares." A brief pause, and then the man said, "My therapist says it's good to vent." You know, this is like a cultural misunderstanding, I think, that it's actually a way to heal our anger, to vent it. And I think we need to look more deeply to see what's underneath it. Personally, one of the best questions I've ever found when working with anger is to ask the question, what else is happening right now? What else is going on right now? Because if you ask that question, it will go deeper. One will see, fear is happening, or powerlessness is happening, or humiliation is happening, or grief is happening. And we'll see that if we're willing to ask the question, it will move it on instead of it being stuck, you know, which is oftentimes where we really find ourselves suffering, because we find ourselves really stuck with it. So I offer you this question as a way to investigate. An alternative to seeing anger as good or bad, an alternative to thinking we only have two choices when we experience anger, which is either to repress it and deny it and think we have to be really tight and stiff and we can't even feel it or it's going to be a problem. Or the alternative you know, which is thinking of anger as something good and justifying it and indulging it in it and getting carried away by it. An alternative is to see if it's possible to not continue with our over-focusing on what it is that's making us angry. You know, this is such a seductive thing, that the what is the whole thing, and that our reaction is, of course, not really worthy of our attention. I like this. George Eliot said, "Anger and jealousy can no more bear to lose sight of their objects than love." Yeah. And I don't know, maybe you notice this, that when we're angry, it's always about something. It might be, as Rodney was saying, the world or God or whatever, but there's always an object. And to remove our attention from the object is really heavy lifting at times, but it is where the exit sign is. Now, it really is the path to coming into a different relationship with anger. So seeing if we can be aware of how we get so stuck on what it is that we're angry about, or who we're angry with, or what situation is happening, and instead to see if we can. And I think this is a bit of what I would call a koan, or an investigative question that you can't immediately resolve. But I think the way to look at it is to see if we can take responsibility for the sensations of anger without blaming ourselves. You know? Like, if you just try to take responsibility, it is likely that you will see it as your personal problem or your fault or something that, you know, this kind of relationship that's embedded in us about how anger is who we are. And when we experience anger, it's really our true nature, that we really are angry, you know, which is not true. I just kind of lost track of what I was saying. Can anyone remind me? All right, it's going to happen to you. Yes, thank you. Okay. I'm so glad I'm not identified with memory. It'd be more and more of a problem if I were. Yes, seeing if we can take responsibility every time there is the experience of anger. You know, seeing if we can not blame whatever the object of our anger is, which I'm not saying lightly, because it is so hard to do that. But the thing is, whatever we practice gets easier. You know, so if we practice expressing anger, that gets easier. You know? If we practice removing our attention from the object of our anger and feeling it, that gets easier. And I think that the tip here that I have for you, which is just huge tip, is to feel it in your body. You know, it's not like you're removing attention from the object and then you're floating out in the universe and you're lost and you know, kind of just being moved around by the forces. One sees if it's possible in that moment to experience the sensations of anger in the body instead of the story of why I'm feeling angry. Because, of course, whenever we're attached to the object of our anger, the story is very much involved. You know, and we really want to notice where thought comes in. Because when we go on and on and on in our attachment to the story, we make it stronger. There's no way around that. Oftentimes we're trying to figure it out. You know, our intentions are good. We're trying to understand why we're angry. We're trying to think about, how can I resolve this? What do I need to do? You know, it's oftentimes that really is the intention. But the effect is that we find ourselves angrier and that we don't even know why. So it's just, so dropping the story means dropping our attachment to the object, seeing if we can make this huge, huge, huge leap of knowing that it's happening in us, and so because it's happening in us, even if we have been extraordinarily provoked, it's still happening in us. So Can we respond to it with love and with compassion and with wisdom? And I'm suggesting that a way, very wonderful way to respond to it is to then explore it in the body, to feel it in the body. You could say that we, in practice, are attempting to stop the expression of anger, meaning not just outwardly, you know, in actions and in speech, which sometimes is hard enough to do, but also inwardly in the form of thinking. You know, so trying to slow down on that or notice what is happening with our thoughts so that we don't get carried away in favor of experiencing the actuality of anger. You know, the rawness of the energy of anger. It can turn into an energy. We're kind of defanging it in that way. You know, it actually turns into something that we can call an energy. And we don't see it as energy when we're caught up in the expression inwardly and outwardly. This is really where a real, the beginning of transformation can take place, in seeing the attachment to the object, which of course has to do with the story about why I'm angry, and then seeing if we can just put it aside for a moment. It's not like renouncing it forever, because that's completely unrealistic. It's probably going to come up the next second, you know? So not having these ideals like this, but just in the moment, the intention to not feed it. And then, you know, kind of this encouraging of ourselves to take full responsibility for the fact that the feeling is happening, recognizing that expression of it inwardly or outwardly is going to perpetuate our suffering, and then to do something quite different, which is to experience it in the here and now. You know, when we're in the story, it's not usually here and now, you know, but to experience the rawness of it, the life of anger. And it's incredibly fascinating when we do that. And if we're doing it in an angry Buddha kind of way, where we're staying very still and we're allowing for the energy to move through us, then it's something that can become quite interesting. And then when something is interesting, then we can explore it more, we can investigate it, we can begin to see what the underpinnings of it are. Okay, one more thing. Hey, I'm doing pretty well.
Actually. You're doing very well.
I am. I felt like I had so much to say in this short amount of time, but I will say at least one more thing at the moment. Maybe I'll just go on a tiny bit more about what I was just saying about the alternative to expressing and repressing, which is, of course, intervening with kind attentiveness. Can we bring a caring awareness in? You know, because when we do this, we get a little space. A little space evolves, and the anger loses some of its destructive edge. In sustaining our attention, and what I mean by sustaining our attention is basically on the physicality of it, you know, the rawness of it, the energy of anger. When we can sustain our attention in the here and now on the energy of anger, it can no longer monopolize our minds. Because we know that when anger is happening, depending on how strong it is, but, you know, many times it takes over. And it's the only thing that is happening in the world. Everything else recedes. And the anger that one is experiencing has taken central stage. Now, this is all that's important right now, is this situation or this person or this, you know, or myself, of course, being angry at oneself, objectifying oneself in that way, and the anger. And so to be aware of it as an energy, you know, with a kind attentiveness, this is what begins to shift it. You know, begins to soften. We begin to learn how to relax in the midst of it so that it can no longer monopolize our attention. You know, so that the world comes in again. You know, because we get so clouded when anger is happening. Our minds become so confused and so clouded. And so we don't want to be monopolized by anything, because then we're under its control. Welcoming this energy as the Buddha would welcome a little child who was suffering, as any of us would welcome a little child who was suffering. Welcoming this energy of anger, you know, not denying or judging in it, not rejecting it, but taking care of it, which is a way to understand it more deeply. Thich Nhat Hanh says that awareness or mindfulness is like the older brother who can take care of the younger brother, which is anger. Yeah. So you're letting the Buddha or mindfulness or awareness take over. You're letting wisdom sort it out instead of thinking that you have to do it all. And the only way this comes about is through the awareness of the experience in its raw form, instead of the perpetuation of thinking. And the last thing I'd like to mention has to do with the role of intention. And I was watching the debate, as probably many of you did, on Thursday night. Did not help my trip on Friday to be up so late watching the debate. But anyway, there was an interesting moment there towards the end when Joe Biden started talking about intention. And I got really excited, because you just never know when the Dharma is going to flow and whose mouth it's going to flow out of. You know? He started saying that something that he learned early on in his career was not to assess, you heard this too, not to assess or ascribe ill intention to others. And this is real Dharma, you know? Because this is what we're doing all the time, and then we're getting angry because of ascribing intention. You know? We certainly can know action, obviously. That is clear. An action is an action. But nobody can actually know anyone else's intention. And when we get stuck on that, when we speculate, as is so tempting to do, when we think we know, then, of course, that's when we tend to take it personally. You know, we tend to see it as something personal instead of it coming from the same place anger comes from in us, which is fear or grief or loneliness or not knowing what to do. Yeah. Remembering something I think that is so powerful, that has helped me so much in my life, and I tend to, you know, bring this up as much as I can in my mind, which is that everybody wants to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. And everybody wants to avoid pain. No one is different in that way. And so ascribing ill intention when we don't know is a way to take something personally and then in its wake to suffer more. Whereas if we remember that others are the same as us, yeah? That each one of us wants to be happy and each one of us wants to avoid pain, that when other people are doing things, it's the same thing. We just don't know what it is. And so the ascribing of intention is really a way to cause more suffering for ourselves and others. Okay, I think I might be done. Yeah, okay, I'm done. For the moment, yeah.